and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the unrest in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the killing of an unarmed black man who had his hands up when he was shot and killed by a police officer in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Kevin Alexander Gray, a civil rights organizer in South Carolina and author of The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama, and a contributor to Killing Trayvon's, an anthology of American violence, joins us to discuss the flagrant killing of the son of a local minister in Tulsa whose car had broken down, yet he was first hit by a taser, then, with his hands in the air, shot dead. And we will also look into the apparent built-up rage in North Carolina's African-American community that was sparked by a shooting of a black man by a black police officer, triggering 2 days of riots in Charlotte. Then we'll speak with Lydia Dennett, an investigator at the Project on Government Oversight, where her latest investigation at POGO is the insidious and totally legal way that industry has infiltrated Congress, which reveals that fellows working as congressional staffers in the House and Senate are having their salaries paid by outside organizations and interest groups, many of whom have real and potential conflicts of interest as these fellowship programs end up furthering industry goals in important legislation. We'll examine the lax Senate rules on ethics that allow this widespread practice, while the House has no rules at all when it comes to their staffers being paid by outside sources. Then finally, Evan McMullen joins us. He is running for President of the United States as an independent candidate and was formerly a CIA officer who served in the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia, then later served as a senior advisor in the House Committee on Foreign Relations and chief policy director of the House Republican Conference. He joins us to discuss why he's running for president and how he is appalled that the leaders of the party of Lincoln are not taking a moral stand against their racist standard bearer who panders to white supremacists, as well as his concerns that a former intelligence officer like himself, Vladimir Putin, is manipulating Donald Trump, who is carrying the Kremlin's water. And joining us now is Kevin Alexander Gray, a civil rights organizer in South Carolina and author of The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama. He's also contributed to Killing Trayvon's, an anthology of American violence. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Alexander Gray.
Thank you.
And given that the work you've done on the Trayvon Martin case, it's extraordinary that these situations keep repeating themselves, the most flagrant being the recent shooting of an unarmed black man in Tulsa, Oklahoma, with his hands up. His car had broken down. That was his only crime.
That wasn't a crime.
Well, I meant that ironically.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's a pillar of society. His father is a minister. What explains these repeated outrages?
You know, I encourage everyone to go out, and I'm not just hawking a book, but the Killing Trayvon's book is more than about Trayvon Martin and George Zimmerman. It talks about the whole incident, all the incidents of police violence that seem to occur every day in this country and have occurred throughout history. And so, you know, I think when we're working on it, I'm one of the editors. We knew it was an important book, and we knew it would always be relevant. But, you know, the simple fact is that this country has always viewed black people as the enemy within. I think Alexis de Tocqueville talked about it decades, hundreds of years ago. And, you know, there are people that still feel as though black people are the most violent people among us. And police... I mean, if you want to talk about what institutional racism does, institutional racism feeds that narrative throughout history. I mean, we see the contemporary cases with Walter Scott, with Terrence Kircher, with Brother Scott and Charlotte. So, you know, and it goes on and on and on and on. Sandra Bland gets pulled over for not using a signal. And it goes on and on and on. And a lot of it has to do with the racist nature of policing and institutional violence. A lot of it has to do with the militarization of police forces across the country. A lot of it has to do with the institutional idea of social order and control of that group of people that you think are the so-called enemy within, but something has to be done about it. And this idea that police can deprive people of their due process, can invoke the ultimate penalty, the penalty of death, without fear, when they're wrong, of being challenged on it, of being held to justice, that's the problem that everybody's been facing for a long time. That's what Colin Kaepernick and these NFL players and these kids in high school and college are now protesting about. And it's what caused the protest in Ferguson. It's what's caused the protest in Charlotte. And as a black man in America with a son, with grandsons, with granddaughters, it's scary to think that every encounter that we have with the police, that we have to get out of our cars or sit in our cars with our hands up, and where they can see them, even for the most minor offense, for fear of being killed, and that's got to be dealt with.
And it's worth noting that Scott's killing was the 214th of a black person by U.S. police this year out of an overall total of 821.
Well, I mean, people seem to forget that. But I mean, black people are disproportionately killed by the police, but white people are killed by the police too. And as I said, we have to go back and look at this idea or giving police the power to shoot to kill. And often, unarmed people, and often if a person is charged with a crime, the penalty for the crime, if the crime is adjudicated, certainly wouldn't warrant the death penalty. And then when you go back and look at the most dangerous jobs in America, well, police, being a police isn't the most dangerous job in America. It ranks somewhere between being a ground maintenance worker and a maintenance worker. This idea that 9/11 has driven the police to want more power, that police forces across the country use SWAT to execute simple warrants. We have to get control of the police state in this country. We have to get control of police organizations, and police, like every other citizen in this country, need to be held accountable when they commit a crime.
And in terms of the riots that have been going on in Charlotte for two nights, and they may well go on for a third, the killing of Keith Lamont Scott by Brently Vinson, a police officer who is, I believe, African-American, of course,
that's in question.
What do you mean? What's the question there?
Well, you know, there are some people that are alleging that the black officer wasn't the one that pulled the trigger.
Uh-huh.
And people are raising issue with the fact that the police department wouldn't release the video. And well, as we say down south, it feels like something's rotten in the cotton.
Right, but they did release the video to the family. At least they have given the family access to the video.
And the family has hired Justin Bamberg, the lawyer who represented Walter Scott in Charleston, because Keith Scott has family here in South Carolina. And everyone's disturbed, and they want that about what they saw in the video, and they want the video released to the public.
And the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Chief, Kerr Putney, who I believe is also African-American, what is his excuse for not releasing the video?
Well, North Carolina passed a law that said the police didn't necessarily have to release a video immediately after such incidents, and he's relying on that law. And they're claiming that they need to study the video more. Unlike what they did in Tulsa, Oklahoma, after Terrence Crutcher's shooting, what we found in South Carolina, and it's so ironic that South Carolina, the home of the Confederacy, is leading the nation in how you deal with these cases with police violence. You know, they hold police accountable. You know, there's really no really good excuse for not being transparent. If you have a press conference and claim you're seeking transparency, then be transparent. And Charlotte, North Carolina, is already facing backlash and a boycott over HB2, the bathroom law. And certainly what's going on in Charlotte and how they're dealing with this latest controversy isn't going to help their reputation, and it certainly doesn't help the reputation of police organizations generally across the country holding their people accountable. We're hoping that that video will be released and the truth will come out and people will know how to respond to it. In the meantime, young people are in the streets, and you know what? I call them protests. Now, it's a shame that property is being destroyed, but you know, young people are leading the charge to hold people accountable. And as an older, senior brother in the community, I support the fact that they are out in the streets protesting. As I said, I hope no one gets hurt. I hope they protest nonviolently. I hope they limit or try to stay away from committing property damage of people who had nothing to do with that shooting. But people need to be out in the street. People need to be outraged, and they need to demand reforms of the police department, and those reforms need to be substantive. They need to be demanding that police review and the community reviews this idea of giving police the right to shoot to kill, and look at this age-old excuse that police use every time they kill somebody that their life was threatened, because that's their catch-all. We need to talk about citizens review boards with the right to subpoena witnesses and bring charges, and we need to hold police accountable the same way we hold everybody else accountable when they commit a crime.
So the of course the dispute, there is a dispute with Scott's family insisting he didn't have a gun at all and he was holding a book that he was reading while he was waiting for his son. The police say they recovered a handgun but no book at the scene.
Well, they lie. Sometimes police lie, just like they lied in Connecticut about planting evidence
right
on that protester that just came out. Right. Police lie.
Right, but surely the video will settle.
The video, well, there you go. If you want people to know the truth, release the video. But right, the record is very clear. Police will lie to cover up for other police.
And Scott is the sixth resident to be killed by the Charlotte police in the past 12 months. So is that, in your opinion, Kevin, Alexander Gray, that this incident kind of sparked a pent-up rage that was in that community?
Well, you look, as I said, how the police relate to black people across the country is, you know, from my experience, is pretty much the same. They see black men as more violent than everyone else. That is the old stereotype that they paint of us. And of course, in Charlotte, with what happened with the young student from Florida A&M who was running toward the police for help and got shot, or the white man who reached in the back of his car for a cane. This idea that citizens are somehow the enemy combatants, and you have to approach them ready to kill them, when the numbers don't show citizens, black or white, with some fatal and violent animus toward police in some sort of epidemic way, we have to go back and look at how these police are trained, what's on their minds. We have to weed out the police that are racist. We have to weed out the police that are incompetent. We have to weed out the police that have a militaristic attitude toward serving communities. They are not a paramilitary force. They are here to protect and serve. They are here to protect the Constitution. They are here to protect the constitutional rights of all citizens, be they guilty or innocent. It's the court's place to determine whether or not someone is guilty or innocent. It's the court and the jury's place to decide whether or not someone gets a death penalty, not someone who holds a racial bias towards someone to think that the moment they pull up to that person, they've got to be ready to kill them.
Well, as I mentioned in the beginning, Kevin Alexander Gray, there seems to be much, much less ambiguity in terms of the police shooting of Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma, by a police officer, Betty Shelby. That was captured on police helicopter video and a patrol car.
With the reporter from on high talking about, that looks like a bad dude. He's in a helicopter. Mm-hmm. And somehow or another, a man walking with his hands in the air looks like a bad dude. And so how do you come to that? How do you read inside someone's mind that you don't know who is walking with their hands up to say that looks like a bad dude? Just ridiculous. Or, you know, the man doesn't have a gun. First of all, his car breaks down. And so when does someone's car breaking down become, and him waiting for assistance from the police, become a situation where he's got to have his hands in the air and guns are drawn on him? What does that say to every black person in America when their car breaks down on the side of the road, that they can expect, that they have to be prepared to show a police officer because their car has broken down on the side of the road, that they mean that officer no harm? That puts all of us in danger. And that cannot stand. If every interaction that black people have to have with police is to be totally submissive, something that no white person has to do, white people do not come have a conversation with their children at some point in their lives and say, this is what you have to do when you approach a police officer. They don't have that conversation, but black people have to have that conversation. And enough is enough.
Well, in this case, there was also, in the case of Terrence Crutcher in Tulsa, Oklahoma, there was also video from the dash cam of a police car. But what it captured was that the victim here, who's only, again, his car had broken down, his hands were up, he was first tasered by one of the Tulsa police officers. It was after he was tasered, which I think really does immobilize anybody, that he was fatally shot by Officer Betty Shelby.
Well, back on that particular case, your car breaks down. That man is not on your radio to as if you're the police officer. No one's saying, get to this location. This person has committed a crime. They get a call that his car broke down, and some moron joking, well, he might be high. But his car broke down. So when does you responding to someone whose car has broken down, where does it go from that to you showing up with your guns drawn, tasing him, as opposed to approaching him like a normal citizen that has rights and that's a human being and saying, how can I help you? And even if he were high on drugs, it would be your responsibility to help him. Even if he were high, and none of that's been proven, it would be their responsibility to help him, not kill him.
Well, it's extraordinary, though, to try and figure out what do you think motivates an officer like this, Betty Shelby? Because she, you know, as I mentioned, the victim here, Mr. Crutcher, was already tasered by another police officer. This all happened in 30 seconds.
Well, in the case of her, I just think she's a damn idiot.
Right. But in case of, what is this, a fear?
Look,
what are they doing?
Institutional racism has people believing that black people are the enemy within. Mm-hmm. That's what it's all about, the stereotype, the age-old stereotype of the violent black man. Mm-hmm. That's it. Now, we can intellectualize that for the next hour, but that is fundamentally it. And she should never have ever been a police officer if a man walking away from her with his hands in the air, who has been tased, and she's got a gun, and it's obvious that he doesn't because his hands in the air, if she felt threatened that somewhere in her training, someone should have figured out that she had a problem.
And she shot him in the back, as far as we can tell.
I shot him in the back, a cowardly act.
Well, you know, it's definitely got people's
attention. I want to respect her humanity, but she certainly doesn't seem like she respects the humanity of black people. She certainly didn't respect Mr. Crutcher's humanity.
Well, as I say, it definitely has got people in this country quite riled up, and the presidential candidate, Hillary Clinton, spoke out against it. Even Donald Trump made some ambiguous. Normally makes racist comments, but in this case, I believe he's trying to reach out to the African-American community. So he's moderating his tone.
You know, I guess it's the old saying on that video, which the cops are trying to argue, who you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? But, you know, in the case of Mr. Crutcher, you know, it's just sad that it takes, and it happens all the time. You know, we wrote a book called Killing Trayvons, plural. Mm. And that book came out a couple of years ago. And this idea of police killing black people isn't new. Mm. It's just now. And it's just that we have everybody that can film a lot of these incidents. And luckily, there was a dash cam. We'll see what's going to happen and what the case will be when it all boils down in Charlotte. But obviously, there's something wrong in this country that has to be addressed. And the problem is white supremacy and institutional racism and how black people are dealt with by law enforcement. We might have a war, so-called war on terrorism, but when I check the numbers as to who's in jail, it's black people. And a lot of what's driving that is racial profiling. And what drives racial profiling in a contemporary sense is the war on drugs. You know, racial profiling isn't new. Ask a Native American, ask anybody that's a descendant of an enslaved African. All this is based on racial profiling. We've been racially profiling since the boats come in. So, you know, we have to come to grips with this country's history of racism and white supremacy and what that means in an institutional way. Racism isn't about black people simply not liking white people or white people simply not liking black people. It's about a structure that stereotypes people, a structure that deals with people based on stereotypes and has the power of life and death. That's what racism is about. Bigotry is about not liking people of another ethnicity or color or whatever, but racism is about power and institutional power. And that's the difference. I mean, you can have a black police chief and a black police officer, but if they're acting on the impulse that a black person is going to be the one most likely to hurt them, then that's structural and institutional racism.
Well, Kevin Alexander Gray, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Kevin Alexander Gray, who's a civil rights organizer in South Carolina and author of The Decline of Black Politics from Malcolm X to Barack Obama. And he's also contributed to Killing Trayvons, an anthology of American violence. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into an insidious and totally legal way that industry has infiltrated Congress. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Lydia Dennett, who's an investigator at the Project on Government Oversight, where she works on safety and security of nuclear weapons and power facilities, foreign lobbying and influence, and works with Department of Veteran Affairs whistleblowers. Her latest investigation at POGO is the insidious and totally legal way that industry has infiltrated the Congress. Welcome to Background Briefing, Lydia Dennett.
Thank you for having me.
And it's pretty extraordinary to just your article at POGO begins, this is the insidious and totally legal way that industry has infiltrated Congress. Let me just quickly read. In January 2001, Peter Winoker began working as a fellow in Senator Harry Reid's office. He would ultimately spend almost 4 years there specializing in energy policy and eventually becoming the senator's energy and transportation advisor. But there's one major distinction. His $120,000 a year salary was paid by the IEEE USA, an industry group that is an organizational unit of the Institute of Electrical and Electronics Engineers, in other words, a lobbying group. So this practice apparently is pervasive. I had never heard of it before. I mean, as bad as Washington, often referred to as Nigeria on the Potomac, is, this is a new low, if you will.
Yeah, it really is. And it was something that we weren't familiar with at the Project on Government Oversight until very recently. And when we discovered, we thought it was just another example of how industry can sort of insinuate themselves into Congress and potentially even affect legislation that will affect their careers and their industry.
So all the examples you've given, and there are quite a lot of senators, a lot of Democrats, and some Republicans, from what I can tell, though, that most of these fellows that become staff members and have their salaries paid not by the government but by these outside interest groups, it seems that most of the interest groups are sort of organizations associated with, you know, the nuclear industry, for example, where Senator Lamar Alexander, the Republican of Tennessee, has people from a managing contractor at the Oak Ridge National Laboratory, UT Battelle, that's, I guess, affiliated with the University of Tennessee. But then you've got groups like the American Psychological Association and the AAAS, the Science and Technology Policy Fellowships of the AAAS. So are we to conclude that these are the only types of people that are infiltrated into Congress? Or do staff members represent, for example, corporations? You know, so at this point, I'm trying to get a distinction between the kind of people that are paid for independently and yet come across as Senate staffers, whether or not they're all from industry professional organizations as opposed to pure, you know, commercial operations like Coca-Cola.
Right. We didn't find any direct examples of specific industries like Coca-Cola or, you know, specific oil companies or any kind of things like that placing fellows. But and we did find, you know, of course, many more than those that are mentioned in the report. We found several universities were placing fellows, organizations like the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation or the Congressional Hispanic Caucus Institute. They both placed a lot of fellows as well. But we were finding that the records that the Senate keeps are so sort of spottily filled out, or they're incomplete or inconsistent, that it's really impossible to know exactly who is taking advantage of this program, both on the industry side and on the Senate side. And of course, the House doesn't require any kind of disclosure at all. So the public has no idea who's using this fellowship program on that side.
So what is the disclosure regime? There's none in the House, which is pretty alarming, but what kind of disclosure regime is there in the Senate? In other words, how did you find out that all of these salaries of staffers in the Senate were being paid for by outside groups?
So on both sides, they are allowed to have these fellows in their offices that are paid for by third parties. But on the Senate side, they have a specific rule that requires the fellows to agree to comply with the Senate Code of Conduct, and they have to file that agreement with the Senate Ethics Committee at the beginning of their fellowship, at the end, and then at the beginning of every quarter while they're there. And additionally, their supervisors have to file a report on individuals who perform Senate services. And those reports include who is the source of their compensation and the amount or rate of that compensation. And so while we found that, you know, they were, the compliance with this rule was spotty at best. It was a lot better than on the House side, where they are still required to comply with the Code of Official Conduct, but they don't have to file any paperwork agreeing to do so, or any report on how much they're being paid or by whom.
So when you say the House of Representatives have no requirement for disclosure, what's the explanation for that if the Senate has it? Is this something that at the discretion of Paul Ryan, or is this just some kind of tradition?
We're not exactly sure why the rules differ on both sides. They are both required to comply with the codes of official conduct. There is specific language in both the House Ethics Manual and the Senate Ethics Manual that these fellows cannot work on any kind of projects that might even give the appearance of a conflict of interest. But on the House side, there's no real way for either the public or the Ethics Committee to really monitor whether or not that's happening. And so we have been trying to work with members of the House to get a rule changed for the new Congress.
But why would Senator Harry Reid have this fellow, Peter Whitaker, spend 4 years on energy policy and eventually becoming the senator's energy and transportation advisor? If, you know, I don't know how you separate their expertise from the people who are sponsoring them.
Right, exactly. And it is sort of a fine line to walk for both the fellows and their sponsoring senators or members. And it's something that in the ethics manual, they're kind of required to be reviewed on a case-by-case basis. And, for example, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, they do an ethics training for their incoming fellows and remind them that if they're asked to work on projects that might give the appearance of a conflict of interest, to sort of remind their sponsors that they're not really supposed to do that. And it is possible that they're working on big bills and they're not directly writing or working on the legislation that will affect their sponsoring industry, but in at least a few cases, in the ones that we laid out in the report, there was at least the appearance of a conflict of interest. And since it's a program that is mainly supposed to be for the educational benefit of the fellows, they're generally a year long. Having somebody there who is there for 4 years and is essentially a Senate staffer, but is still making a sizable salary from their sponsoring organization, it leads to questions of, who they're really working for.
Well, but that's pretty key, isn't it? I mean, I always assume that these important Senate staffers, and let's face it, without the staff, a lot of congressmen and senators wouldn't know where the bathrooms were, I mean, they really do rely on these people. The assumption's always been that they're government employees. So do you have any idea of what percentage of Senate and House staffers are actually being paid for by outside groups?
We don't have an exact number. As I mentioned, we found that there was a widespread lack of compliance with this rule. So we found several examples of senators who had never filed for any fellows, while their sort of sponsoring organizations were saying, no, we actually had a fellow in that office in that year, but there were no records available for them. So it's a little difficult to tell exactly how widespread this program is. But we do, at POGO, we're very concerned about the sort of deterioration of congressional research staff, and which has gone down about one-third over the past 40 years. And so that's why we have a congressional training program to help teach staffers about oversight. And so we do realize that it's important to have these knowledgeable experts in Congress. We just like additional oversight on exactly what they're working on.
And a lot of them seem to be associated with the nuclear weapons program, which is your specialty, Lydia Dennett. And we know, for example, going back to the Manhattan Project, that Robert Oppenheimer wanted the Manhattan Project to be under the umbrella of the University of California because they just didn't want to basically be a bomb-making group. They wanted to maintain the idea that they were scientists as opposed to engineers, and that has sort of created this massive Department of Energy outsourcing to universities and to the various national labs that the DOE runs. So how much are they, when you look at the fellow that Lamar Alexander had it from Oak Ridge, he was with a contractor, but then the contractor seemed to have a University of Tennessee connection. I know there's an awful lot of contractors, not just in the Department of Defense, but also in the Department of Energy. So how many of them are, you know, like Oppenheimer intended scientists as opposed to engineers working for contractors?
So most of the Department of Energy national labs, and many of them, or a few of them, are specifically nuclear labs. They are run by contractors who are often sort of a conglomerate of several different contractors. Some of them are defense contractors, and some, as you mentioned, are universities. But they're still private contractors, and they still have, you know, multi-billion dollar budgets that are ultimately decided by these senators and members and the committees. And so when you have the example, like in Senator Alexander's office, where he has a fellow from the lab in his state, Oak Ridge National Laboratory, which is run by a contractor, UT Battelle, and they're paying their fellow something like $100,000 a year to be in that Senate office, and it's the office that is deciding the funding for that lab, it certainly presents a conflict of interest to the outsider.
Well, these are sole source contractors. Their entire company, which is a private company, is on the taxpayer's dime. You bet they're interested in keeping the gravy train going, right?
I mean, yeah, exactly. And the example that we found in Senator Alexander's office, it is certainly related to funding, but it's also things like specific carve-outs, and what we talked about was the Federal Information Technology Acquisition Reform Act, which was a bill to have agencies better track how they spend their IT budgets. And the Department of Energy National Labs launched a very successful lobbying effort to get a carve-out from that requirement. And it was Senator Alexander who kind of led the charge, and while he was doing that, he had a fellow in his office who was paid for by the contractor who runs these labs. So it's certainly funding, but it's also, we're concerned about other things as well.
Well, Lydia Dennett, I thank you for joining us to fill us in on this new phenomenon, which indicates how much, you know, I won't use the word corruption because it's maybe too loaded a term, but how much influence peddling and back-scratching and mutual interest goes on in Washington. This is a whole new set of outrages, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Lydia Dennett, who is an investigator at the Project on Government Oversight, where she works on safety and security of nuclear weapons and power facilities, foreign lobbying and influence. And she also works with the Department of Veteran Affairs whistleblowers, and her latest article at POGO is The Insidious and Totally Legal Way That Industry Has Infiltrated Congress. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back joined by Evan McMullen, who is running for President of the United States as an independent candidate. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Evan McMullen, who's a former CIA officer who served in the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia, spearheading counterterrorism and intelligence operations in some of the most dangerous places on Earth. Having completed his CIA service in 2011, he transitioned to the investment banking division of Goldman Sachs in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then joined the House Committee on Foreign Affairs as a senior advisor, and later became the chief policy director of the House Republican Conference. He is currently running as an independent candidate for President of the United States. Welcome to Background Briefing, Evan McMullen.
Hi, Ian. Thank you very much. Happy to be with you.
Thank you, Evan. And what's your sense of where things stand with your candidacy? It seems that Hillary Clinton is not doing well, and Donald Trump's on a kind of a surge. And some of the explanations I've heard is that not only is Hillary Clinton losing votes to the Libertarian candidate, a lot of Republicans are sort of coming back to the fold, if you will. Is that what's happening? Because your candidacy is intended to give disaffected Republicans an alternative.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think we're definitely doing that. We're 5 weeks in. And we see our poll numbers rising. Our challenge, because I was someone who wasn't famous, and I wasn't a career politician, so we're trying to increase my name ID. But as we do that, we find that people are jumping on board with our effort and supporting me. And we see our poll numbers going up as a result of that. Certainly it's very difficult. We're running a 3-month presidential campaign. The reason why we're doing that is because we think Americans deserve a better option. And in fact, Americans think that. These two major party candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, have historically high negative ratings. Only 9% of the American electorate cast a vote for either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. They're very, very unpopular. This country is not on the right track. Americans know it. And they want better leadership. And neither Hillary Clinton nor Donald Trump can offer it. So we got into this race late because, I thought somebody else would get in, somebody who had perhaps run for president before. That didn't happen. And so at the last moment, I decided that if no one else would, I would. So our goal is to block Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump from gaining the majority of votes in the Electoral College. And then the election would go to the House. That's very difficult. It depends on how close the race is between them and our performance in certain states. But that's what we're trying to do. Whether we're successful or not, we're offering what I believe is the beginning of a new generation of leadership in this country, specifically a conservative movement, a new conservative movement that rededicates itself to the cause of individual liberty and also to the tolerance and the inclusiveness that I believe should come along with anyone who's committed to liberty. And I think that's been missing from the Republican Party. And so we're offering new leadership that does both of those things.
And I recently interviewed James Fellows of The Atlantic, Evan McMullen, and he coined the term, I think, Vichy Republicans in reference to the leadership of Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell, in the sense that they are lacking in moral fiber. I take it you have made the similar statements, that you feel that the Republican Party, since you were policy director of the House Republican Conference, has, in a way, lost its moral standing by holding their nose and going along with Trump.
Oh, there's no doubt about that. I'm saddened to see the party of Lincoln not stand up as their nominee refuses to repudiate the support he's receiving from the white supremacist movement in this country. Of course, not all of his supporters have anything to do with that, but a strong segment of his support comes from this white supremacist movement known, I guess, as the alt-right movement, as well as a candidate who has so aligned himself with Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin is one of our biggest adversaries, and it's not just because we've decided that Vladimir Putin will be an adversary. Vladimir Putin is an adversary because he does everything he can to undermine basic universal rights of people around the world. He supports Bashar al-Assad in Syria, who's carrying out a systematic slaughter of innocent Syrian civilians, as well as while he destabilizes Europe and democracies in Europe. Vladimir Putin does not have our best interests in mind whatsoever. In fact, he opposes what are our interests, our basic interests. And here you have Donald Trump, who is aligning himself with an adversary of our country. And then, more alarmingly even, you have the Republican Party, who refuses to stand up to it. So I just think, you know, the Republican Party has been proud of the fact that it was the party of Lincoln. I don't see that party of Lincoln anymore. And the Republican Party has long been proud of its credentials on national security. I don't see that either right now, because they're clearly, their own candidate now has become Vladimir Putin's biggest stooge.
Well, I know I've talked to some people who investigate offshore money, et cetera, and there seems to be a confluence of interest between the Siloviki, which are the former intelligence officers turned oligarchs that are Putin's inner circle, and Donald Trump, in as much as the Siloviki are under sanctions and they can't park all their ill-gotten gains, and Trump himself has been blackballed by Wall Street because he's taken so many banks down. So do you have anything on that? Because I don't know where the Siloviki end and the FSB and the SVR begin.
Yeah. Well, I have not been studying it. I have read the reports that Donald Trump is dependent upon Russian oligarchs for the financing of his real estate deals because U.S. banks decided that his creditworthiness was not what it needed to be for them to be involved in his projects. So, look, that creates a natural conflict of interest. If I were applying for the CIA today and I had depended upon Russian oligarchs to fund, you know, anything that I had done, I can guarantee you I would not get the job. I would not be able to get a security clearance. Yet Donald Trump he's been compromised by the Russians, by the Russian government, through these financial dealings as they've been written about. But it's not just that. Donald Trump has a massive ego, and Vladimir Putin is a former KGB officer who's been trained to identify people with such large personal flaws and weaknesses and then exploit them. And that's exactly what he's doing with Donald Trump. But it's not that difficult, because in addition to these weaknesses, financial and character-wise, Donald Trump is sympathetic to authoritarians. And he himself, I believe, is a true authoritarian. He admires Vladimir Putin. He's admired the dictatorial activities of the Chinese oligarchs, the Chinese communist government of Saddam Hussein, Kim Jong-un, and others. So this is a man who we can expect to behave, I think, in a way that that he admires, or he admires these authoritarians, and we can expect him to behave similarly.
And again, I'm speaking with Evan McMullen, who's a former CIA officer who served in the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia, spearheading counterterrorism and intelligence operations in some of the most dangerous places on Earth. Having completed his CIA service in 2011, he transitioned to the investment banking division of Goldman Sachs in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then joined the House Committee on Foreign Affairs as a senior advisor, and later became the chief policy director of the House Republican Conference. He's currently running as an independent candidate for president of the United States. But Evan McMullen, do you think that Putin is tipping his hand, that he's trying to tip the scales in this election? There's been a lot of evidence so far that Russian FSB and GRU, Cozy Bear and Fancy Bear, they've been called, have infiltrated various servers, the DNC, the Clinton Foundation, etc. And there's a sense that, at least to some of the Russian experts that I've talked to, that Putin is frankly, you know, normally when you do those kind of cyber espionage intrusions, you don't leave your fingerprints. And there's a sense that Putin is basically in our face saying, you know, he believes that we've interfered in the colored revolutions, and he blames Hillary Clinton for the demonstrations against him after he extended his tenure in 2011. And so do you think, one, is Putin interfering in our elections? And two, is he doing it in our face, like this is payback?
He certainly is. There's no question about that. I mean, that's obvious for a number of reasons. You have RT America, which is the Russian cable channel here in America, has been undermining our democracy with its Russian propaganda, you know, in English. for some time while it continues to support Donald Trump. So that's been very clear. Of course, there are these hacking incidents where the Russians are trying to reveal information that will favor Donald Trump by harming his political opponents. These are the things that he's doing. And I, whether he is not hiding them because he's trying to do it in our face, or another likely, I think, scenario is simply that he doesn't think he needs to hide them. And he's proving that he can do these things and do it relatively in the open, and it won't make a difference because, frankly, people aren't paying close enough attention to it. These are the exact types of things that he's done in Europe, and he's done them with success. And I think we, our leaders, need to stand up to it and need to call it for what it is. And if they won't do that, then the American people won't understand that this is a problem and we need to stand up to it. You know, that's the problem. And that's going back to the Republican Party. I just think it's just so incredibly disappointing that even though Putin is taking these kinds of steps to undermine our democracy, the Republicans fail to stand up and call it for what it is and condemn Donald Trump's allegiance to Vladimir Putin. So I just don't know what kind of legitimacy the Republican Party will have after this election on national security or on the issue of equality, given that it hasn't condemned Donald Trump's the support that the white supremacists offer the Trump-Pence campaign. What legitimacy will they have in those areas? I just don't know.
Well, of course, the Republicans have always enjoyed an advantage being the preferable steward of national security. That's been the impression that they've given, and they've had a much deeper bench in terms of national security experts. But the idea that they could give that all away is pretty breathtaking. But why do you think the public's not getting engaged, Evan McMullen? Why does Trump have support? You know, you'd think that people would be alarmed that a foreign government led by a guy, I mean, in fact, I don't think we've ever in geopolitics ever had this phenomenon of the combination of national security and organized crime, the mafia and nuclear weapons. And yet they are supporting Trump, at least a lot of them. A lot of American people appear to be supporting Trump. So what explains that sort of lack of alarm?
Well, these are things that, you know, clearly you've studied and paid attention to, but I just think the vast majority of people, you know, aren't watching closely the world of espionage and don't understand, you know, how exactly it works beyond the films and television shows they see. It's just not, and for good reason. I mean, these are things, as you know, that happen in the shadows, and they can happen in an open way, but in a way where people don't pay much attention to them. It's just, you know, these are things that are not, you know, familiar to people. And so I think they sort of discount. I think a lot of people, frankly, will hear this conversation and maybe dismiss some of it because, you know, they wonder, you know, how problematic could it actually be? But it is very problematic. It will, you know, what Vladimir Putin does is he sows seeds of racial and religious and ethnic division in countries, and then he promotes leaders who galvanize those movements and ride those movements to power, ideally, and thereby advantage Russia by turning a country in on itself, by undermining democracy's core ideals, which are liberty and equality. If he can do that, then he has a freer rein to do the kinds of things he wants to do in the world, which are destructive, by invade neighboring countries or countries that are further away. This is what he's trying to do. He knows better than many Americans understand that a lot of our power comes from our ideals, ultimately, because that generates a global goodwill for the United States that allows our military to work with other militaries, our businesses to do the same, and our diplomats and intelligence officers to also do the same. So it's, you know, he knows that if he can undermine our values, turn us against each other and turn us inward and make us feel like we should not engage with the rest of the world, we should not be a voice for liberty and human rights in the world, then he's going to have a freer rein to do what he wants to do, which is to expand the Russian footprint. I mean, Vladimir Putin has ambitions to, you know, restore the Soviet Union, essentially, and he can't do it if we're standing in the way. So he's eager to get us and the Europeans out of it.
Well, just returning to the campaign, Evan McMullen, you're running for president as an independent, although you, and I guess as a conservative alternative to Donald Trump, you got in the race late. I think you're in 11 states, is that right?
We're on the ballot in 11 states, and we're registered as a write-in in another number. The total number is 27. So by the time November 8th rolls around, we'll be on 40 to 45 states. Either you can write us in or vote for us, and we'll have all that information on evanmcmullen.com. So you can go and see in your particular state if you'd like to cast a vote for us. And we're opposed to Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. We believe it's time, I believe, it's time for a new generation of leadership in this country. And so I encourage people to visit our website, evanmcmullen.com, sign up to volunteer, please donate. We need your support. We don't have the support of a major party. We're making progress, but we depend on the support of good Americans out there who want a better choice in this election.
And so far, you seem to be doing well in Utah and Virginia. So just in closing then, tell us about this strategy that you mentioned about the Electoral College. There is some indication that for the longest time, Hillary Clinton's had an advantage with the Electoral College, and you may end up with an anomaly with Trump winning the popular vote and Hillary Clinton winning the Electoral College. But you think it could be even more complicated. And if it does go to the House, that is the lame duck House, the current House, right?
Yes, it will first go to the House, but the I believe the representatives who will vote on the situation will be the new House. But the current House will have some say over process.
Uh-huh.
So and I apologize that my people are telling me that I've got to run, but the idea is just that we'd like to block both of them. Yes, it's difficult. Yes, it will depend on the race being very, very close. But we're making progress in the Mountain West, in Virginia. In some states, we haven't been included on the polls, but we believe we're making progress there too. We just have to convince the pollsters to actually put my name on their surveys. So, but we're making progress, and you know, we're going to fight until the end.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Evan McMullen.
All right, thank you, Ian.
And we've been speaking with Evan McMullen, who's a former CIA officer who served in the Middle East, North Africa, and South Asia, spearheading counterterrorism and intelligence operations in some of the most dangerous places on Earth. Having completed his CIA service in 2011, he transitioned to the investment banking division of Goldman Sachs in the San Francisco Bay Area, and then joined the House Committee on Foreign Affairs as a senior advisor, and later became the chief policy director of the House Republican Conference. He's currently running as an independent candidate for President of the United States. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.